Now, if you're really smart, what you can do is you can sample a noise, and if your noise blanker has an external input or an external antenna input, you can help it, but you ain't going to get rid of it. And again, the problem is not the boards or the microprocessors. The main microprocessors are in most vehicles in various different places, but they're encased in a real case that's grounded and closed with, what do you call it, RF gaskets. You know, the metal gaskets that look like braid. And it squeezes on that. The actual amount of noise that the vehicle makes within 10 feet complies with part 15, which is all thereafter.
So I think you're saying all the wiring going to that microprocessor, it's got probes all over in the carburetor and the exhaust system and everything else. So all of that wiring to all those probes are really miniature antennas radiating all that computer noise. Is that sort of what's happening, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
That's exactly what's happening, but I can be a little more specific. Whereas where you mentioned like the gas pedal or the automatic throttle, those things generally are solenoids. So those things are hooked up to transistors which drive them. They're not really the problem, but you have something called a wind bus. I forget what it stands for. But all the buttons in the car, like the windows and the buttons on the steering wheel, they all travel down one wire, and it's a 0 to 12 volt square wave that's going at various different rates. Now, the CAN bus in some cars run about 25 megahertz. The LIN bus is a bit slower, it runs around 5 megahertz or 3 megahertz. So you can imagine that these wires that go everywhere, that are unshielded, by the way, the CAN bus is differential. So they run it as pairs. They weren't really quite smart enough to twist them together, which would reduce the noise even more. But, you know, car manufacturer has to make it as cheap as they possibly can. K2RIW, K2 again.
Comment, comment. Go to the second, George. The ideal situation would be twisted pair used in a fully differential manner. In other words, when one wire went plus 1 volt, the other wire went minus 1 volt for one particular state, fully differential, and then it would be a hell of a lot quieter. Sounds like modern-day automobiles and HF ham radio are almost incompatible unless you're willing to do a hell of a lot of rewiring. Almost no one is willing to do that. Mr. FIU, you've got it, George, K2IW.
One little comment. CAN bus has become popular for machine automation, so you're beginning to see it in other things. We're even using it in the broadcast world.
Is CAN bus fully differential, Eric?
Repeater, time out.
Yeah, it's fully differential. And it's a lovely bus. It's impervious to everything. We use them in transmitters, which is cool, because you can flood those things with RF, and it doesn't bother it.
As long as the data receiver has enough dynamic range that the common mode RF voltage doesn't overload it. You've got it, George, K2RIW. And so, from your point of view, this is a very difficult one to solve. Is that true, George?
Don't have an answer to that. Thank you, KD2FIU. Dick, I gotta agree with Eric on something here. There's so many things going on. Changed the fuel pump in my tank and found that while the engine is running and the fuel pump is going, I cannot key up repeaters with the 118 CTCSS tone. Shut the engine off. I key them up. Key on, engine off, fuel pump not running. I could key up the repeaters. I lost the 118 CTCSS tone with the new fuel pump that I put in. Just a comment here to say that Eric is right. There's so many things going on. KD2FIU.
Oh, that sounds a bit strange. You can't key the repeater. It's probably more you can't receive it.
What's happening? happening is while it's on, it's actually distorting the frequency of the 118 CTCSS tone.
All right, if that's really happening, then that's coming up your power line. You can actually do something about that, but I think you said you had the fuel pump change, so you solved that problem.
I'm just supporting what you were saying about so many different things. If the fuel pump was changed and the problem started, so I'm just going to leave it alone.
The fuel pump got changed, and the problem started. They put the ground straps back on, you know, because generally the fuel pump's on the top of the tank. You got to drop the tank. You got to empty it, make sure there's no fumes in it when you change it. And there's all these little things that clamp onto it to keep the RF noise out. And most of the even some of the dealer mechanics aren't aware of it, and they, we don't need this, so they just don't put it back.
Only one frequency. So, just supporting what you were saying there, a lot of things can be wrong.
I will say this, you can order a car that's essentially almost RFI-free, but that's a special order, and you'll find that, I know the American manufacturers do it, I'm not sure if the Japanese do, but you can get a vehicle that's specifically designed for that purpose. They do that for the police cars. Actually, if you've ever seen one of the FCC, the Suburbans, they're big Suburbans with a fake roof. It's funny. And the antenna system that's in there, I don't know if you've ever seen the inside of their vehicle, but there's a nice Hewlett Packard spectrum analyzer, and made by Rockwell and Company, is a control panel display which has the spectrum analyzer display on it. It's got a Doppler. It's got stuff that you can't imagine in there on that display. It's like looking at an aircraft cockpit.
So I think you're saying, Eric, that a Sirius radio amateur can buy an American-made automobile, and maybe some of the Japanese ones, that are specifically made to be RF-tolerant. What's your guess as to the premium cost to buy that special capability? Are we talking about an extra $200 for the car? Over to you, Eric.
No, I think it's a lot more than that, because the all of the communication in the car is still on CAN bus, but they use shielded switched cable. They actually do DC wiring to the windows and that kind of stuff. You know, all the fancy, you don't get the fancy little buttons in the car because they, you know, they're essentially designing a vehicle specifically for that purpose. So, no, I think the number's in thousands of dollars, but I'm not sure.
So for a police department to pay that extra money, I can see it. I suspect almost no frugal radio amateur will do that. What do you think, Eric? Wait for the beeps.
No, if you're the kind of guy that buys a $10,000 radio, maybe. But that's not most of it.
I'm getting the impression among you HF guys, because I'm a VHF person, and I've had a lot of ignition noise, even on 2 meters. 2 meter sideband, you got a beautiful blanker and a good receiver. But 2 meter FM doesn't have a blanker, and the limiter is not enough to take out the ignition noise on 2 meters on my, that was then an automobile. So it sounds to me like there's a lot of horror stories of the noise coming out of automobiles disturbing the HF equipment, and the HF equipment in some cases disturbing the computers. So that's a rather incompatible mix of ham radio and automobile. Doesn't sound like there's any glamour fix on this one. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW?
Yeah, well, I will say this. Most car manufacturers are thinking that you're putting in, like, a two-way radio for a taxi cab. Or, well, police vehicles is a separate animal, but they tell you where to mount your radio, how to run your cables, where to stick your antenna, and how to power it so that you don't bother the computer in the car.
So I think you're telling me if you follow all their instructions, assuming you're going to the particular car manufacturer that's willing to give you all these instructions, it turns out pretty well on, say, 40 meters. Go ahead.
No, I'd say 6 meters and up, because then you're starting to get to the point where the harmonics are really low. HF is a problem. By the way, ignition noise in most vehicles today, new vehicles, is a very minimal thing, because the ignition coils are actually right at the head of the spark plug.
So if it's a four-cylinder car, you're telling me there are four ignition coils in the car, is what I think you're saying, Eric. Go ahead.
Depends on the manufacturer, but the days of a distributed cap and carbon wires leading to your spark plugs are long since gone. But yeah, they still make them that way, but the more modern cars have a little thing that clips onto the top of the spark plug, and it's got a little wire that comes off of it, and that runs right to the computer, and that sends a pulse to it, and makes the sparks.
George, have you almost given up on living with the noise on, say, 40 meters from an automobile?
G2AMZ for a quick comment.
Yeah, George first and then Mike in that order. So what's your final solution for you, George? KD2FIU, K2LIW?
No, Mike, KD2AMZ, was having a problem with his experiment. I was mentioning how I lost a CTCSS tone on 2 meters when I changed my fuel pump, which really was incredible. I couldn't understand that. But, yeah, there's a lot more to this. By the way, I know that we have a long night ahead of us, but there's a lot more to this, and a lot more experiments have going on. Mike was having the problem with the 40 meters. KD2FIU.
Very fine, George. So, Mike, were you able to solve this, or is this an ongoing problem? Mr. AMZ, K2LIW.
For the time being, I abandoned HF mobile in my car, but I'm going to repeat again. Eric said he was able to get from Ford how to do, a two-way radio in the car, how to run it. I spent, oh my God, probably 4 hours calling various people in Subaru, from corporate to their mechanic people to their engineers, and their basic word is, no, we do not support any two-way radios in a Subaru, unless, of course, it happens to be an HF, Subaru model XYZ. I'm being sarcastic about that one. But they were very emphatic about it. Their answer was, don't do it. By the way, my 2-meter 440 worked fine. But, again, Subaru... And again, I spent a good 4 hours trying to get through, as per Eric, he said, try to get through. They were all emphatic. One person said no, then another, and another. There was a total 100% consensus from Subaru. Don't do it. KD2AMZ.
So from what you found up to, Mike, I think you're telling me a ham radio operator should not buy a Subaru, or... is there a Subaru, super fancy model that is made for RF, but it probably has a ridiculous price? Over to you, Mike.
Well, I'm sure that they would do. I mean, if they're business savvy people and say, hey, listen, we're going to offer you this diamond version. I'm sure they have a diamond version that's going to cost like some obscene amount of money. I'm sure they have it. But it'll probably cost 4 times the value of a standard Subaru, maybe 12 times the value. But again, I haven't seen too many Subaru, Forester, police cars out there.
With what I was just going to say, the vehicle is being used for a police car, they do it differently.
Eric, Have you ever seen a Subaru police car, or are we talking about something that doesn't exist?
I'm only familiar with the vehicles that I've bought or had things to do with. None of them have been Japanese. I know there are Japanese police cars. I mean, I've seen them all over Japan and all over Tokyo. But, actually, if you look into them, they're nothing like their production model. They're made specifically for that purpose. The engines use the microprocessors that make them run efficiently, so they're not going to make those things go away, but you can actually minimize the RF from that stuff. And by the way, nobody really actually makes anything intended for RF. We're talking 2 ways, 6 meters, the commercial band, 30 to 50, and 150 to 170, and so on and so forth. And they don't expect you to be running 100 watts in the car, so they give you a place to mount your radio and how to power it so that you're not going to saturate the stuff in the car and then make the computer just go out of its mind.
It sounds like there's almost a horror story here of trying to make compatibility between modern-day automobiles and HF ham radio equipment. Have you heard of any success stories at all, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Well, you notice if you go to, like, Dayton or stuff like that, you'll find guys in pickups with, the big antennas on the back and some other kind of vehicle. And generally, they manage to live with it, but they're still suffering from noise pollution.
So I think you're telling me if they want maximum sensitivity on HF, they have to pull over to the side of the road and turn the engine off? Is that what they got to do?
Well, in my vehicle, I've been able to get to a point where I can actually operate 40 meters while I'm moving. But I tell you, when you pull over and turn it off, you hear stuff you're not hearing.
Sounds to me like you've arrived at the spot where you're about to do a repair. Is that true, Eric?
No, I couldn't actually get to the modem. The modem itself is housed in the radio station on the other side of the building, so... And actually, the guy who's in charge of that radio station that runs the stuff is probably listening.
So I think you're telling me that, the 975-375 and the IRLP might not become operational tonight. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, we are operating one repeater tonight. And unfortunately, there's nothing I can do about it. Although I have some ideas on how to get around this problem, but I got to talk to somebody Monday. Actually, I really want to put a Wi-Fi link or Ethernet link, except that the part of the building where I could put the antenna up against the window was facing the wrong way, so we'll come up with a solution at some point.
Meant to help finish.
Go right ahead.
2FIU. If we might want to consult some mobile CB operators who run high power.
My impression, and I may be wrong, is that the average CB operator is a little bit more of an appliance operator. Not too many of those guys get deep into electromagnetic interference and electromagnetic compatibility problems and solutions of them. But I might be wrong. So, you think the guys running high power on CB have got some magic solutions that the HF ham radio operators haven't discovered? Is that sort of what you're saying, George? Go ahead.
No, I don't think they have magic solutions. I'm just saying we might want to consult. So to say that, do they have any ideas in what directions that they've gone for this? Some CB operators run an incredible amount of power. than it is, even if the upper portion of HF. But they do run an incredible amount of power. And they're driving around and they're not shutting their vehicles down.
1010YDY.
Go ahead, Hank.
I have to agree with George. Years ago when I ran 10 meter out of a car I had in Detroit, I found a CB shop up there that's unfortunately long gone at the moment. But the guys knew a lot about suppressing RF problems and helped me get my old Radio Shack HTX 100, which granted does not have a lot of power, but it allowed me to operate out of the car I had as an airport car up in Detroit.
How many years ago are you talking about?
I can't remember if it was 99 or 2000, but in that time frame.
I'm not an HF operator, so therefore I've got this question. For the guys that are trying to do HF from an automobile, is the problem worse than 160, 80, 40, 20, 15, 10? Which frequency region is the problem most difficult? Over to you guys. Give me your call letters, K2IW.
K2IW.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, it depends upon the vehicle. I've got some quiet spots, but they're not that terribly quiet. Actually, the higher the frequency you go, the worse it gets.
Comment in 1YDY.
Got it, Hank.
I was driving a Ford EXP at the time, which was already an older car, and my problems were worse higher in the frequency band than lower.
So all those square waves coming out of that computer gives you lots of higher harmonics. And I think part of what's going on here is that as you go down to 80 meters, the noise of the atmosphere is equivalent to about a 30 dB noise figure. So the atmosphere gets noisier. Therefore, you don't hear as much noise out of the automobile, even though the noise may be almost the same. So that's a factor. The real antenna looking at the horizon sees less and less noise from the environment as you go up in frequency. It falls off 6 or 12 dB per octave. So that's a factor. Therefore, you become more vulnerable at the higher frequencies.
Practice, I don't agree, and I'll tell you why.
Go ahead, Eric.
We know that 80 meters get to be a noisy band. Depends upon the time of day, too. But the ultimate test is you turn your car off, turn your receiver on 80. And the noise floor is probably like an S3, S4. You turn the car on, all of a sudden it becomes an S7 and S8. So, you know, you're adding to the game. Oh, and the other thing is, CBs tend to not try to listen to very weak signals. You know, the range is somewhat limited for them, so the signals in their receivers are pretty strong, which overcomes the garbage in the car.
Comment.
Go ahead, George.
CB operators running 2,025 out of their vehicle and they're not shutting it down.
My comment was just that the guys I ran across in Detroit were working skip and they weren't using a lot of power, but they were, you know, very interested in long-range signals.
Are the guys on 2 meters and 450 also running into similar noises and incompatibilities with automobiles?
Well, if you're FM and you don't notice it very much, although I noticed I get a birdie at exactly 146.52. I move off one way or the other, and then there's nothing happening, you know. When I'm listening to folks on 5.2, I gotta set the engine off if they've got a weak signal.
That's your particular electric vehicle. I presume only that brand name does that on exactly 146.52. And that signal on 5.2, what is it, roughly 10 dB above the noise, Eric?
Yeah, it's pretty strong. If you move away from the frequency, it's like nothing's there. It's fine. It's just, yeah, maybe it's just this particular vehicle. And it's constant. It doesn't move. That's probably the DC to DC converter in the car. Because that's going at a constant rate. Everything else is variable.
If you had an all-mode receiver, and you listen to that in a single sideband mode, I wonder what that would sound like.
No, I could play it for you now. I mean, it's sort of a single raspy tone. I had never looked at it on a scope.
But I was using my 751 Kenwood 2-meter all mode for my automobile, because I was quite often talking to some sideband people. Boy, there was quite a few frequencies where I could find birdies from the onboard computer in the automobile. So they're noisy. So it's a difficult mix. We all like running mobile rigs, but to live with that automobile, for the automobile to live with your rig and for you to live with the automobile, it's a marriage of incompatibility, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, George keeps talking about transmitting. Transmitting's not really a big problem. It seems to be a problem in the Subaru, but most of the stuff is pretty well shielded. So, you know, I've transmitted a kilowatt in the car. It doesn't bother the car, but it sure does make my receiving deaf.
Now, Mike was giving us an example of where, in the case of Subaru, I think the computer goes kind of bonkers, needs to be reset. So when you're transmitting on ham radio equipment in some of these modern-day automobiles, do you sometimes get strange operations of the engine, so to speak? What do you think, Eric?
No, I don't. I run my power cables where they recommend, and my antennas are in the zone where they recommend, so it's far enough away from the computer that it doesn't. I've never had a problem. I know of other people who have had problems, but it's usually from where they run the power lines, how they get to the battery, and some people are not very bright and don't put them to the battery, and their problems are even worse.
Mike, from the problems you described, was that engine almost inoperative if you didn't reset it? AMZ, K2LIW, wait for the beeps.
The engine was operative. I had the codes come up, and you could tell it was running a little weird. It felt like it was running a little rich. You know, a little bit of hesitation until I reset it, and then I went through the cycle, you know, the IMEI cycle, I think that's what they call it, or the, I forgot the name of the cycle. Eric, you can help me with that, where you reset all the parameters and they reset themselves after a certain bit. It ran a little funky for about 10, 15 minutes.
Most people don't realize that the computers at the engine control, actually a bunch of different modules, they load up tables from when they first start the engine, and it's constantly recording parameters and then compensating for it. So when you give it a blast of RF and you wipe the tables out, the computer doesn't know what it's doing until it starts filling it up again.
It sounds to me like if you went and got an inspection because the tables got disturbed, your car might fail emission inspection. If you've used your ham radio just before going to that inspection. What do you think, Eric?
Say yes, KD2MZ. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, when you're going for an inspection, they hook up their computer to your OBD2 port, and actually there's a signal, a parameter that comes back to the computer that says, yeah, you've passed an emissions inspection. Actually, if you notice, they don't stick a sensor in the tailpipe these days because the computer in the car is doing that for you. If you had an OBD2 reader, there's usually a red and a green light on it. The green light means you pass, and the red light means you ain't going to pass. And if you disturb the table, you don't drive that 50 miles, you're not going to pass.
KD2MZ, when I put my reader on, Eric, the IMEI, or whatever they call that thing, the parameter, it was red, so I had to reset it. So my car had an inspection 3 days before I did the test, and if I would have went back to the station, I would have flunked.
That Subaru that was giving you this grief is is that something that you owned, or you were just borrowing it to find out if you like its compatibility? Over to you, Mike.
This Subaru is my Subaru, and quite frankly, I love this car. I swear by Subaru. This car has been, like, nothing but ultra-reliable, runs great. I love this car. I recommend Subaru to anyone, except in this one situation, KD2AMZ.
This one situation means what? A 40-meter ham radio running 100 watts?
That's exactly what I mean. But to the average consumer, it wouldn't mean anything. But that is the only problem that... You know, I would say, you know, that you would have, and that's something, well, I just won't do that, but yes, trying to explain it again, I'm trying to explain it poorly. Great car, love it, it is my car, it just does not like the RF. When the check engine light kicked on, that code, I forgot what they call it, it would have failed emissions. Not that it's because the parameter table probably got wiped from the RF, my guess. I don't know. But I had to reset it, and I had to run the car for a while to get my green light back on. I had to run it for a few days.
Okay, you like your Subaru, and you like ham radio. Does that mean you do no HF from your Subaru? You do only VHF, UHF? Or you do no ham radio at all from your Subaru? Over to you, Mike.
VHF, UHF work fine, so does DMR, causes no problems. The only problem I had, and that's all I can say, is 40 meters, 100 watts. I can't tell you if 80 meters, 60 would do it, 20, I can't say. The second that check engine light came on, I killed the power to the radio, and that's it.
Tune in, 1YDY.
Go ahead, Hank.
I want to know what type of antenna he was running when he had this problem.
Go ahead, Mike.
It was a temporary antenna which I had in the approximate location of where I wanted to mount my antenna. The antenna was a 41-foot vertical. Yeah, a bit extreme, but it was a vertical, going to a 9-to-1 onion, then going to a remote tuner. The remote tuner then went into my radio, which was sitting on the passenger seat. Yes, the RF cables were kind of twisted up and together through the firewall. Yes, the antenna ground, and everything was grounded to the chassis, to the nearby chassis, so I had a good RF ground. Again, RF ground. And, again, it probably went into the buses, and it caused all kinds of problems. So, again, I would not recommend HF, maybe at 10 watts it would work, but I would not recommend 100 watts on 40 meters in a Subaru 2013 Forester.
You have the temporary antenna mounted.
It was mounted next, and it was grounded via cabling. Actually, it was grounded. I didn't want to attach it directly to the car, because how could I? I did not want to spend $400 on a screwdriver. But again, it was the same thing. It was the RF emanating more than likely from the antenna, which caused the problem. Which also brings me to another point. Suppose I had an antenna and I was operating this and I pulled up next to another Subaru within a couple of feet, I could have caused their check engine lighting to kick in. So my answer, and I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to do HF in my car.
Do HF in your car, but I'm just curious, where did you physically have the antenna? Was it on the roof line, or was it mounted next to the car, or was it mounted on the hood area?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Radiating element was in the vicinity of where it would have been if it was physically attached to the car. But again, it was grounded, so no matter what, I wouldn't recommend it. It's just not, a car just does not like it, and I'm not going to go through it. And again, I'm going to repeat again, Subaru engineers from Cherry Hill, that's Subaru USA, I have talked to them. I know I talked to a number of them, and every single engineer at Subaru said, no, do not do this. They more than likely have a version, like a police car version in Tokyo, but I'm not about to spend an extra 20, 30, 50 grand to get that.
To FIU.
Go ahead, George.
Like I was saying about 15, 20 minutes ago, it's not a valid experiment to have the antenna remote. I don't believe it is. Somehow, it's not working like that. You're going to tell me that if I drive up next to you with a 40-meter tuned hand stick on my car and tee up, I'm going to drive your computer bonkers? I don't get it. It's not like the antenna system was part of the vehicle.
Okay, what's not clear, George, is that if it was a permanent installation versus a temporary installation, what would be different? Over to you, George.
He keeps mentioning a something 41-foot remote with a good RF grounding. How do we know it's a good RF grounding? Is it just an electronic test meter grounding that's good? I'm not sure. I don't understand what the 41-foot remote antenna has to do with an mobile antenna installation. If that's the case, if the antenna is remote, if I were to drive up to you with a 40-meter handstick, which is working perfectly good in my vehicle, am I going to affect your vehicle?
If his Subaru is sufficiently sensitive on its computers, maybe. Mike, you said you run a number of coax cables through the firewall. You said that a few minutes ago. What coax cables are you running through the firewall? Where are they going and why? Over to you, Mike.
Twisted pair. Power lead. Twisted. Going straight to the battery. You know, right through the firewall. Cable, as if it was routed, it went right through the back to the back car, coming right out where it would have, you know, plain old coax, where it would have left the vehicle where you would mount the antenna. Yeah, so again, when I use the term mobile antenna, it's an antenna I happen to have and I use very successfully at field day. It's a piece of wire going straight up into the air. How does that sound?
And the local sheet metal was the counterpoise, is what you're saying, at the bottom of that piece of wire. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, who is that that's making another comment?
Thank you, Dick. This is George, KD2FIU. How many feet long is the antenna itself?
Piece of wire going straight up, 41 feet. So this would be like the ultimate portable antenna. Not loaded. If I would have loaded it like a screwdriver, yeah. Again, it's a pure wire 9-to-1 onion going straight to a remote tuner so it tunes into the radio. All within less than a foot of each other. So it's short leads, RF grounding under 8 feet. So everything is fine. So the test proved the results very clearly.
That 41-foot piece of wire, was that suspended in a tree? I can't believe you had a 41-foot whip, but go ahead.
Matter of fact, I did. I used a 41-foot. I used an MFJ 1910 mobile telescoping fiberglass pole.
Okay. I think somebody's trying to get in, but he's just a pure dropout. Try speaking a lot softer and give us another transmission.
Thank you, Dick. It's George again, KD2FIU. So if I have a Subaru of the same model, and I drive up next to you, and I park next to you while you're doing this experiment, is it I'm not asking you, Mike. I'm not asking you if you know the answer, but I'm just asking out here on the TechNet, is it possible that my computer would go down too? If I were to be next to that 41-foot experimental wire antenna, I'm not seeing this all coming together as a radio station application.
Well, it was an experiment. I think it's time we move on to the physics and science section, which is going to be run by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. And you've got a number of different subjects you can discuss tonight. I think we're going to enjoy any one of them. You got it, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra with the science talk, or however you want to call it. I thought maybe I would ask if anyone had any science-like questions up front. And if not, then I have a whole grab bag of things that I could talk about.
Let's see if anybody has a suggestion. If so, give us your call letters right now. Looks like we're ready for your grab bag, Roy.
Okay, very good. Now, it's a shame people are shy, but hopefully they'll stop being shy eventually. I'll take a couple of questions that I got from the chat room last week, by the way. I checked the aliases, and I had already set the alias for AC2GS, chat.ac2gs.com. So it was already set up. I had simply forgotten that I set up that out. So the question that one of the chat room people asked, which is interesting, is he asked why life didn't evolve to use waves. They evolved to use light waves. They evolved to use sound waves. Why not radio waves?
You better make your voice a little bit softer. You're occasionally dropping out, Roy. So the main question is, why didn't Mother Nature, in her evolutionary process, we've got bats that go up to 90 kilohertz of UHF frequencies for their chirping and listening. Why didn't Mother Nature use radio for communication between animals? It would get much greater range and much better reliability. How come Mother Nature didn't do that? Anybody got any guesses as to why not? K2IW?
Interaction, it did. We see radio waves. Interaction.
Okay, Wesley, you don't see radio waves, you see visible waves.
Correct, there are radio waves. Electromagnetic waves and radio waves are the same. Do you see the difference?
Usually people use radio waves to describe below the visible light spectrum of electromagnetic waves. I know it's just a matter of semantics, but that's why I mentioned that organisms can utilize light waves as opposed to calling them radio waves.
But the original question was, radio waves for communicating between animals. Yes, our light-sensitive eyes can receive that electromagnetic spectrum that we call optical, but we don't transmit it. We're not communicating directly with light transmissions.
Well, both. The visual information is much more than the audible one. You want to check it in Wikipedia?
organisms are capable of generating light. There's a lot of fireflies, a lot of luminous creatures out there that can actually generate light. So it is possible for living things to generate electromagnetic waves at light frequencies. The problem is when you get to radio frequencies.
Radio frequencies, electromagnetic frequencies, there is no difference. Entrixie.
Yeah, photoluminescence by adenosine triphosphate, the lighting tail of a firefly, for instance, that's a chemical light-generating system. So that works at optical frequencies. I don't know if you can do a chemical generation of an RF frequency, which I think is the original question. Is that true, Roy?
That's not true. That's not chemical. Entrixia.
Yes, Wesley, in the case of biological, it is chemical. The way that a biological device tends to power things is through a charming little molecule called adenosine triphosphate. What happens is when it breaks down sugar with oxygen, it phosphorylates a molecule that has two phosphates into three phosphates that have a high energy content. And then that's used as a chemical energy device to charge up a lot of things, including the luminescence, the chemical luminescence mechanism that produces a firefly's light. It's chemistry. And human beings use chemistry because we don't have batteries in us.
ADP to ATP and back occurs in our mitochondria. We don't make light with it, but we still use it.
Again, I oppose. The certain type of shrinks make luminescence by mechanical means, not the chemical one.
Reaction causing phosphorescence, causing the light to come, and so it's a chemical reaction is all that I'm trying to. It's not like a light emitting diode where there's a battery and there's P and N junctions and what have you.
Yeah, a lot of that was a double where N2XJN no. Wes was talking on top of you. Wes, you have to wait until you're addressed, please. So you may have to repeat the beginning of what you said. The first 60 seconds was covered up by Wes. Roy, go ahead.
Okay. What I'm trying to get across is that luminescence is basically a chemical reaction based on the potential energy of the third phosphate chain in adenosine triphosphate. It's a chemical reaction, so it's chemiluminescence. It's not like light-emitting diodes. It's not based on batteries. It's based on chemistry. But again, that's light, visible light. We're able to see visible light. Some creatures are able to emit visible light. The question this gentleman asked is why no one uses what I will call radio frequency radio waves, which to me are those that we would recognize as in a radio, from very low frequency to microwave frequencies. That's what I would call radio waves. Otherwise, I'd call them electromagnetic waves, which is any from zero to cycles per second.
I think that was Eric, is that true?
Yes, it was.
You got it, Eric.
Most biological things, it's totally based on chemistry. Dr. Roy is absolutely right. You know, you're thinking in terms of, okay, adenosine triphosphate is actually causing photons to be given off as the energy levels in the atoms shift from ring to ring. There's also the electric eel. The electric eel has cells that are actually electrocytes. They are a synthetic chemical process, but they can generate like 600 volts or more. So that's not a wave. but that's a lot of energy.
That's quite true. There are a lot of animals that can generate electrical charges, and there are a lot of animals who can sense electrical charges. Now, again, it's not quite the same as RF waves themselves, but there are creatures, especially who coexist with electric eels, who can pretty much figure out to get the heck out of the way of these things. So there's a lot of that goes on. But again, we get back to the question, why no RF? And I was just wondering if anyone had any great ideas why. I realize the semantic problems, but please accept my definition of RF for the sake of this question.
VDH with a comment.
VDH, go ahead.
Yes, WA2VDH. Well, there would be the point where maybe Mother Nature knew that during an electrical storm it would be driving us crazy with the static noise that from lightning we would be picking up.
Okay, that's giving Mother Nature a little bit too much of a slap on the back. It's as good as any. Anyone else have any interesting reasons why RF is a no-no?
V2GXM.
VQMNU.
You know, I just had a thought. Can you do it, Jay?
Okay.
Submarine mammals that actually they generate waves. I mean, they use ultrasonic, and bats use ultrasonic. We can transmit 20 kilohertz out of an antenna, so it's not like they're not capable of generating something that's moving quite that fast. I mean, when talking megahertz, that's a lot faster mechanically, but, you know, in the animals, you're creating that output mechanically. You're using energy to move a diaphragm or whatever the mechanism is that they're using, but to generate RF that you can stick into an antenna, that's a whole other story.
WB2GXM with a comment?
Stop.
Yes, Tom.
GXM, go ahead.
Mother Nature is obviously sympathetic to the ham radio movement. If we could sense radio frequencies, we wouldn't need amateur radios, we wouldn't need the ARRL, wouldn't need the FCC, wouldn't need anything like that. Wouldn't want to go out and buy any or create any electronics, and all the fun would be gone. So Mother Nature obviously knew. K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM.
Yeah, I think you're having fun with us, Rich. You got to be careful now. You guys are mixing up real radio, electromagnetic transmission, versus acoustic. A bat at 90 KC is making an acoustic sound, not a radio sound. Wes wants to make a comment on this. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, that's right. So the problem that we have is that Dr. Roy made an exclusion. So he said about chemiluminescence. And for me, there was exclusion of sonar luminescence, which is sonar, bristle shrimps. And most of the creatures used actually a clamping sound that increased the temperature up to 4,000 degrees Celsius, but that is only a preliminary. Some of the hold on. Okay. Some of the of those creatures reach the temperature that is much higher. Now the sonar luminescence by itself creates the temperature that is many times hotter than the surface of the sun. And this is in the water. So my problem with Dr. Roy is an exclusion, or I didn't understand it properly.
KD2MNU with a comment.
WS2N.
Okay, yeah. alcohol, but before that was KD2MMU. It sounds like Mike Uniform. Is that true?
That's Mike November Uniform.
Okay, give us a name and your comment.
Okay, the name here is Dan. Thanks for passing it over. I was just listening in for a little bit. Just my two cents. I think going back to the original question, you got to think about what's one of the largest energy producers in our neighboring area of the universe, right? So that would be the sun. You got to think about the black body radiation or the solar spectrum of the sun. And what part of the spectrum does that peak in? I think that's a big clue in to why we're so prone or in tune to seeing visible light, the visible part of the spectrum.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dan. The visible part of the spectrum is the peak of the energy coming out of the sun. And our eyes just happen to be sensitive to that, overly coincidental. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, you got a Paul.
I'm thinking about how these creatures would have had to evolve. If they're going to transfer on 20 meters, they're going to have to grow some kind of an antenna out of their head, and it would have to be too long, and they wouldn't be able to maneuver right. So I think natural selection has kind of ruled them out. It would have been good, though. It would have been a form of ESP. They would have been speaking to one another, on 20 or something. But I think it has to do with natural selection, eliminating the problem. You would need some kind of transmitting device, even if they could generate RF inside their body chemically. Back to Roy.
But Paul, theoretically, they could communicate in the near field without too much of a problem, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's true. Ground wave. I'm thinking of sky wave. Yeah, you're right. Ground wave. They could be right next to each other and transmitting.
When it comes to the transmitters on HF and VHF and UHF frequencies made by man, every one of those transmitting antennas for transmitting and receiving contains metal. And so for an animal made out of protoplasm to collect that amount of metal represents a problem. Well, it doesn't have to be metal. It has to be a very good conductor. So could you generate enough very good conductor to act as an antenna within a protoplasm animal? Yes, it sounds possible. But now to generate that, let me pick a number, 144 megahertz transmitting signal, how can protoplasm do that? That's a real difficulty. Maybe you know of a way of doing it, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
AC2GS. So unfortunately, I can't give you a mechanism because evolution never got around to it, but I think we're circling around the ultimate short-term answer question. Evolution, biology, tends to use the stuff it finds around already. As someone mentioned, there's a lot of visible light coming from the sun that no one else is using. So even very, very early single-cell organisms evolved to tell the difference between light and dark, and then everything else was just kind of improving on the basic underlying principle. The problem with radio frequencies, if you will, is that there's no consistent transmitters available at first. So you would have to evolve both a transmitter and a receiver, and that's asking a lot about evolution.
KD2ORE.
Yeah, there is RRE. We'll get to you in a second. KD2RRE, I think it is. Kilo Delta 2, Romeo, Romeo, Echo. By way of the laws of physics, we knew the sun was making radio noise. We knew that for a lot of years, centuries. And a tremendous number of experiments took place to try to measure the radio noise coming out of the sun. They all failed. The very first time that sun noise was detected was in the middle of World War II. It was a radar set in England that started picking up some extra noise when the antenna was aimed toward the sun. That was the very first time that radio noise was detected by mankind with fancy pieces of equipment at that time. So the radio noise are the loudest thing we've